This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, a beleaguered EPA under a media blackout critiques Navy plans to increase unpopular Growler aircraft operations. What started out as an emergency winter homeless shelter becomes a year-round operation. And woodworkers enjoy eggs, coffee, and community at the Port Townsend School of Woodworking Founders Breakfast. So now, let's go inside the Compass. In a carefully worded letter with a deferential tone in response to the Draft Environmental Impact Report, or DEIS, for a proposal to add 35 or 36 new Navy Growler aircraft and to increase by 46%, from 88,600 to 129,000, the number of annual field carrier landing practices on Whidbey Island landing fields that has been bitterly opposed by many island residents, who have complained the exercises have caused heart attacks, hearing loss, forced relocation, and multiple harms to communities and wildlife, the Environmental Protection Agency declared the DEIS to be insufficient in its assessment of the human and environmental effects of the noise the increasing operations would cause, and recommended actual on-the-ground monitoring of the noise impacts rather than estimations through modeling algorithms upon which the DEIS relied. The letter, signed March 8th by EPA Region 10 Director of Environmental Review and Assessment R. David Allnut, also recommended a list of medical journal articles with titles like Noise Pollution, a Modern Plague, and Burden of Disease from Environmental Noise for consideration in the final EIS, and that those actual scientific studies combined with actual measurements from the ground rather than averaged predictions be used to create a, quote, supplemental health assessment of the affected population to characterize baseline conditions and projected health impacts of the proposed action to inform a pathway forward, end quote. Noise was not the only concern addressed. The EPA letter also asked for consideration of the effects the increase in growler operation would have on attainment of the requirements of national air quality requirements for the region, and requested that the Navy, quote, as part of the final EIS, identify measures being taken to prevent further contamination to the sole source aquifers from legacy or new firefighting chemicals. A reference to the fact that the Coopville aquifer has been contaminated by perfluorooctane sulfonate, a fire retardant used by the Navy. I phoned Navy spokesman Ted Brown to ask how the Navy would respond to the EPA letter.
Does the EPA have any more sort of standing with the Navy than any other respondent?
I would say that we are going to obviously review all of the comments. We take all of the comments seriously. And in the final environmental impact statement, we will have a response to each unique comment. Obviously, we do appreciate comments from the public and from other federal agencies.
But so the EPA, though, has no more weight than, say, my comments or the Sierra Club's?
Again, we do appreciate and treat all comments seriously.
I see that the EPA has, like, various levels, which includes, like, at the for this extreme, like unacceptable. So if the EPA were to say it was unacceptable, would that have any more weight?
I'm not going to speculate. That was not the case with this comment. So
right, but it seems to open up the possibility that they could call the final EIS unacceptable if the recommendations are not.
Well, again, I'm not going to speculate on something that is hypothetical.
Okay, but I've asked you this question once before. So the final approval of the EIS, though, is not the EPA's to make. It's actually the Navy's, right?
Yes. After the what the process will entail is sometime this fall, we do anticipate publishing and releasing to the public the final environmental impact statement. Comments will be addressed as part of that document. After a mandatory minimum 30-day wait period, sometime after that, sometime probably still within this calendar year, the Secretary of the Navy or designated representative of the Secretary of the Navy will issue a record of decision.
There was no response from EPA officials for comment on the letter. Not surprising, since multiple federal agencies, including the EPA, are under an executive order from President Donald Trump not to communicate with the media. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News.
At this point, we have served, I quickly counted the cards, 147 individuals through the season. Our averages have been staying up into the 30s. We've been up into the 40s. I think 44 was the most. Did we have 46?
48.
Wow. We did have the 48?
We had 48, okay. Last night of February.
The numbers have continued to take care of themselves, guests coming and going, that we have not had to turn anyone away for spatial reasons. And that's been since we began down there in the Legion 11 years ago. It's good that the numbers have taken care of themselves. We haven't had to say, nope, you can't come in other than for behavioral reasons, people not following the rules. Those are the reasons that people have not been allowed to come in. But if we have increase next year, we need the city or someone to help us have some overflow space because we will not be able to accommodate it down there.
That was the report on the most crowded season yet at the winter shelter located in the lower level of the American Legion Hall, made by Church of Christ Minister Carl Hansen, who also serves as the chairman of the board for COAST, the consortium of local ecumenical groups that for the past 12 years has organized hundreds of volunteers to provide down-home hospitality in a facility that started out as a drafty basement furnished with second-hand overstuffed couches, but which over the years has been developed into a comfortable shelter facility with an approved kitchen, separate sleeping quarters for men and women, bathrooms and showers, a television lounge, and a capacious dining room. COAST is the acronym for the Community Outreach Association Shelter Team, which since 2005 has partnered with local community agency OLECAP to manage the winter homeless shelter. But the occasion for Hansen's report was a press conference at OLECAP headquarters to announce what both organizations say they hope will be only a temporary parting, as OLECAP sets out independently on April 10th to assure that the shelter remains open year-round for its most vulnerable guests, in a program OLECAP's Executive Director Dale Wilson and Housing Director Kathy Morgan have labeled Shelter Plus. To quote from an OLECAP press release on the subject, "There are several fundamental changes that will take place with the implementation of the Shelter Plus model. First and foremost, the new Plus model has at its core a clean and sober residency requirement. Shelter Plus, unlike past shelter operations, will not accommodate guests that are known to be actively under the influence of drugs and/or alcohol. Secondly, every guest will be required to participate in a supportive services plan designed to help them overcome barriers to permanent housing." Here are excerpts from that press conference.
What we've noticed over the last few years, which we've been most worried about, is those in the vulnerable populations. You know, the elderly, the disabled, the veterans, the domestic violence. And they really have nowhere to go. We have no or very little housing. And so we felt compelled to at least try and shelter them until we can get them into permanent housing. So with the new shelter model going forward, people will be enrolled into services and they will be hopefully moving into permanent housing. Yeah, the population, the demographics of the population that come in the wintertime have changed. We have a lot of working people down there that just can't find housing right now also. And we have a lot of people who are just moving around. I mean, they do that in all the different shelters. Mm-hmm. It's easy to, in the wintertime, because of the hospitality model, a lot of people want to come to the shelter. Once they realize that we won't be serving them those nice meals that COAST does, I'm sure it will drop considerably because people won't want to stick around. And that and the fact that we are going to keep with the clean and sober model during these months, just to keep the safety factor down for the people that are the most vulnerable that are in there.
I heard some mention of meals maybe not being as good as they are with the Coast volunteers, but what is the meal plan?
There is no meal plan.
There is no meal plan, so there will be no meals provided.
There will be no meals provided. To start off with, we are not doing any meal service. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the cooks that Coast has and those resources. So, you know, that could change down the road. There might be something different, but that would be something that the advisory committee would be involved in.
Are you guys going to be shut down April 1 through 8? Is it?
We are. We close at the end of the season every year, and we do a thorough cleaning. So it's had some pretty high use all winter for 5 months. Yeah. It needs a lot of cleaning. And during that week, we'll be offering resources to the people that will be leaving the shelter. Coast as well will be helping try and identify places that people can go to.
In the past, when the shelter has shut down, there has been a special effort to supply sleeping bags and tents and so on to people who are going off. Is that happening this year, or is that not happening because the shelter is going to open
again?
Well,
because when we do reopen, it will be only that vulnerable population. So the sleeping bags and the tents, Coast and Early Cap always make sure that who needs one will get one. So that'll still go on the same as it always has been. I'd much rather them get into housing versus a tent. A tent is not housing. It's not really a solution, but if that's what they need, then that's what we'll do.
Is there a sudden upsurge in the amount of available housing this year that you're aware of?
Do you have some housing available, Steve, that I don't know of?
So what are some of the options where you might be directing people to go for housing?
Well, there's other resources out of the community. Kitsap County has a lot more resources than we do. Clallam County has a lot more resources than we do. And historically, in the past, when the shelters closed down, we have referred them, or they've just gone back because that's the county that they're from anyways. So that's going to still happen. We do have limited resources here, as Carl said earlier, but we do everything we can to try and find a place for people. Again, giving somebody a tent and a sleeping bag is not my idea of housing somebody. I can say that with the shelter remain open for the vulnerable populations, that frees up resources for OLECAP. That way, we have a lot of families right now that are currently homeless that do not have access to this shelter. And so we will be able to hopefully house them. We have some resources that we're working on, and we can house the families because we know this vulnerable single population is already being served.
So how is this being funded? Is it mostly through OLECAP, or is the county or anyone else helping out?
Let you answer that.
This will be almost singularly funded through county 2163 funds through the property transfer fees. And those funds are for the longer term, or there is a risk that the legislature would end up reducing those funds to each county. But that seems like a pretty minimal risk at this point for those that might be following that particular issue in the legislature. Something is going to happen. It actually looks like they're going to increase those fees, which is kind of ironic when it started out as a get rid of them. So that actually those dollars may actually increase for the county. If they don't, there's still a balance in that account that would allow the shelter to continue operating approximately 24 months. So. And this, I think, provides a new approach. It's an approach that keeps the hospitality model during the wintertime months intact and make sure that people have that, those protections from the environment. It also offers the year-round benefit of keeping some of the most vulnerable folks sheltered and the ability to work with them on a year-round basis and build that relationship that it takes to get folks to where they're ready and they understand the need for permanent housing, because that's part of it, is building relationships. My view of what has happened over the years is that people enter the shelter for a few months and we lose them at the end of a 3 or 5 month period, and they disappear back into the woodwork wherever they go.
and we lose that relationship. But if we could continue that relationship, at least with some of these folks, it really increases the ability of staff like Michael and Kathy to work with these folks and help them move forward, because they're going to, most of them, a lot of them aren't going to be able to do it by themselves. We know that. But a little bit of help and that relationship building is what this is all about. It's about keeping that contact with folks.
This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News.
In 2007, furniture maker Tim Lawson got together with Jim Tolpin, one of the leading woodworking authors in the U.S., and local cabinet maker John Markworth, and they decided that they collectively had the skills, the will, and the ambition to create a woodworking school right here in Port Townsend, now called the Port Townsend School of Woodworking and Preservation Trades. Drawing on a wealth of local woodworkers in addition to faculty from across the region and the nation, the school has a pool of over 30 educators, which allows it to offer a combination of 12-week courses and a diverse selection of shorter courses for woodworkers at various skill levels. Recently, KPTZ visited the school's Founders Breakfast, an annual recognition of the community's support, where students, instructors, educators, and contributors congregate to celebrate and honor those who have made a significant mark on the school's mission to inspire a lifelong passion for craftsmanship through education in woodworking and traditional building trades.
We're here at the annual Port Townsend School of Woodworking Breakfast. I'm sitting with Rafael Berrios and Colin Cafferly. Looks to me like we have a teaching assistant here and we have a student. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing, Rafael.
We're in the middle of the second to last week of our Foundations of Woodworking class, which is a three-month intensive program, sort of teaching students what an apprentice would have gone through maybe 100, 150 years ago in a cabinet-making job. So kind of starts off with learning green woodworking and then follows along into some more simple shop fixtures, learning how to make straight lines, flat planes, and then turning those skills into real-life projects, which is right now kind of our last week of the student-designed project, which is a frame and panel chest.
So you're a teaching assistant. How long have you been doing that?
Well, I've been a teaching assistant for about 6 months now. I went through the school program, the Foundations of Woodworking, about a year ago, so kind of pursuing my own passions and interests.
That's exciting. Where's home?
Right now it's Port Townsend. Grew up in Southern California, but been up in the Pacific Northwest for about 3 years.
And here's Colin Cafferly. So you're a student here. How long have you been here at this school?
So I've been here just about 2.5 months. I'm taking the first run of a furniture intensive course, a 3-month course, more of a design focused class. We're designing and then building pieces. We've gone through 3 projects so far, and we're on our 4th and final project, which is a freestanding cabinet project right now.
Colin, was Massachusetts and Vermont where you actually got your inspiration for woodworking?
I think my first woodworking job was I worked for a custom cabinet maker in Hinesburg, Vermont, which meant I did pretty much just sanding 8 or 9 hours a day, but it got me interested in building things out of wood and found an appreciation for wood and different woods.
So here we are at the breakfast. What's this breakfast all about?
I think this breakfast is all about community members and students and wood school folks meeting and hopefully getting some publicity and donations and getting together and having a good time as well.
Jenna's actually called Jenny Get Around. And my name is Jenny.
Jenny Monforth. I'm in the foundations course and we've done about 11 weeks almost. And it's been awesome. It's very transformative for me.
Where's home for you?
Well, I travel around a lot, but home is Montana. But I moved out here from Maine, where I was apprenticing on homesteads for the past couple years. And that's really why I came out. I wanted to learn skills that I could use to build my future homestead. So that's why I took this hand tool foundations course.
So how are you liking it so far?
It's great. I love it. I'll probably come back in the future and take another course.
Julia Bonheim. I'm taking the 12-week Foundations of Hand-Tool Woodworking course.
Julia, how have you managed to be able to take this course?
Scrapping together a whole bunch of things. I have the scholarship from the school itself, which has been huge. And then I got a scholarship from the Pacific Northwest Tool Collectors. And then I actually did a matching grant program with Mercy Corps Northwest in Portland, where I save and they match it. So together, that's what it took.
Is Portland your hometown?
Yes, it is. I've been there for 7 years.
What are you doing in Portland?
I'm a natural builder. I do clay plaster, cob sculpture with communities and other kinds of small woodworking jobs.
How has your experience been here? You've been here for how long now?
It's been almost 11 weeks, and it's been tremendously supportive. I love my teachers, and I've learned so much. It's impossible to really comprehend everything until I've left here and can put it into practice.
All right, I'm speaking with Kate Leiserson, and she's a recipient of a scholarship here for the Port Townsend School of Woodworking. She also got up this morning and talked about her background and how she transitioned from what she was doing back east. Tell me a little bit about that backstory.
Well, I'd been working as a project manager in the financial services industry in New York for a long time and didn't find it fulfilling. I took a woodworking class essentially on a whim and just fell in love with it right away. Absolutely loved working with my hands and making something that I could see and touch. In less than a year, decided that I wanted to make it my life's work, or at least hope to, and saved up so that I could quit my job and come and take the furniture intensive class here at the School of Woodworking.
So how's that feel?
Great. I'm grateful every single day. I'm excited when I wake up in the morning. Mondays aren't nearly as awful as they used to be. I'm happy to be where I am and feeling very hopeful and optimistic and happy about the future.
What do you see about the future? What are you imagining? What's your fantasy?
Well, I'd like to make custom furniture for a living. You know, I'm still relatively new to this, so I would like to work for or apprentice for someone or a company making production furniture to build up my skill set a little. Hopefully still do some of my own work on the side, but eventually would like to have my own custom furniture business.
I'm speaking with Kelly Watson, and she's the recipient of the Founders Award here at the School of Woodworking Breakfast. Kelly, tell me a little bit about your passion, especially for education, and how you wound up with limited knowledge of woodworking, but a great deal of knowledge about education. What passion led you to where you're at right now?
Well, I'm really interested in helping young people unleash their potential in whatever avenue that looks like for them. A couple years ago, I was hired by the district to run the maritime programs at the high school level through the Career Technical Education Program, and part of that was a marine trades program. Through great support from the Port Townsend School of Woodworking and their kind of founders and educators, they really encouraged us to take on a hand tool woodworking class, which is called Maritime Manufacturing, and it's really modeled after their foundations course. So my goal with it is to provide students an opportunity to learn hands-on, to realize that they can be really capable craftspeople, and to have the opportunity to gain new skills and explore their capabilities, really.
Where was your home originally?
I grew up in Beaverton, Oregon.
As I understand it, you've done many things in your life to date, right?
I have. I was an Outward Bound instructor for about 15 years, and then worked as a commercial mariner for another 10 in there somewhere. So yeah, lots of outdoor education experience.
Yeah, Steve Harbisesser. I've been in Port Townsend for a long time. I'm still a professional woodworker. I've been in woodworking here for a long, long time. I build gypsy wagons, entry doors, staircases. I've been helping Kelly at the high school, teach at the Port Townsend School of Woodworking also.
So you were telling me there's a little difference between teaching at the high school and teaching at the School of Woodworking.
Oh yeah, if you teach at the high school for a while, teaching at the woodworking school is easy, but it's worth it. I mean, it's an important place to teach. At the high school. Yeah. So that's why I do it. And Kelly's great. She's been doing a great job up there.
I'm speaking with Todd Miller, and he's one of the recipients of the Founders Award this morning. Tell me something about your passion for woodworking and how that all came about.
My passion actually came long before I was ever teaching. I was a high school kid in 1970 and graduated without much idea what I wanted to do. I'll be honest, when I got my draft number and realized I didn't have to go to college, I dropped out of college and got interested in wooden boats, and that sort of hooked me for 20 years where that's what I did, and then I did furniture, and then I actually ended up building a piece of woodworking machinery that I sold. Then after about 20 years of that, I decided it was time to look at other things and sort of fell into teaching, to be perfectly honest. Believe it or not, I thought I'd get more time off than I did running a small business, and that's not the case, but decided that I'd go back and get my degree and get a teaching degree. And I was not intending to be a woodworking teacher at all. I was sort of done with woodworking, and so I wanted to, I was a science major, and I wanted to teach science, which I did for about the first 5 years. And then I got convinced to take over the woodshop class, sort of reluctantly, but I just feel like it's really, it was mentioned here by several speakers, it was just really fundamentally important for kids to see that they can make something, because so much now is gone digital and virtual and all these things, and it's like, at the end of the day, what have you got? When you built a chair or you built a box, at least you've got a box. And I know that the kids who do it, they are sort of amazed at themselves.
As I understand it, Todd, you got a lot of support from the district.
Yeah, the district has been great. When I took the program over, it's a beautiful facility, but the machines needed work or they needed replacement, and the district's been really good about upgrading. And we don't have state-of-the-art computer-driven machines because I'm a believer in learning to do it by hand. But we do have very good, high-quality, just regular woodshop machines, and they're getting better all the time. We're upgrading as we go. So.
I'm speaking with Tim Lawson. Tim, tell me a little bit about the Founders Breakfast and how it got started.
The Founders Breakfast got started when John, Jim, and I realized that we needed to acknowledge the amazing support we've had from the community around us. We were struggling for a way to do that, and I'm not sure where the notion of a breakfast, but the Founders Award was a very clear distinction. And we awarded the first Founders Award to Kate Burke, who at the time the school was being founded was the manager of Fort Worden State Park. And when we were exploring where to site the school and we were offering trial classes, we did them here at the fort. And in doing that, Kate just looked at us and said, "Why the heck aren't you guys thinking about putting the school at Fort Worden?" And she just sort of said, "Figure out which empty building you would like to use." And that was the genesis of why the school is situated here at Fort Worden. And Kate also put a specific twist on that, and she said, "You guys should teach historic preservation. We've got a few buildings that need some TLC." So that became a very easy connection for us to make. And then we went on to recognize the founding chair of the school's board as we transitioned to a non-profit. We've acknowledged instructors like Steve Habersetzer. We acknowledged Kiwi Ferris and the late Charlie Moore, owners and founders of Edensor, because, I mean, just as you've even seen today, the support they give us is phenomenal. And then we've gone on to also honor Yarp Romaine, who was the designer of the amazing porch furniture that you can see on the officers' row houses here at Fort Worden. So it's just acknowledging that envelopment, that sort of shared passion, because all of that feeds the school. I feel like we were this little acorn and it's just sort of blooming into a strong seedling, but that earth that it went into was that richness of this community.
Well, being part of that richness, I think, is quite a satisfying feeling. As I understand it, you're making a transition into satisfying your passions.
That's right. I mean, my passion for the last 10 years has essentially been creating this school, building the team, working with the board, working with the fort, working with the PDA, really just to create this arena in which the school can grow. But in doing that, I've begun to realize my passion is returning to making. As a furniture maker, I've really not made anything in 10 years. And I'm feeling that tiny little scream that you hear inside you occasionally to say, come back to making. And so I know there is somebody somewhere who has the passion, the gift of communication and vision to replace me. Those skills aren't unique to me. There's got to be other people out there, and we want to connect with them.
It's always the blessing and the curse of being a talented administrator.
Yes. I'm not sure how else to respond to that, but yes.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Chris.
From Fort Worden, this is Chris Bricker for KPTZ Compass.
This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans and Chris Bricker. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.